You're listening to Bedroom Beethovens, where notable music makers break down stories accompanied by songs and melodies documenting growth through their 10,000-hour journey. And me? Well, my name is Cello, your host.
It's the Bedroom Beethoven Podcast.
Whoa, you just blew my mind because nobody talks about that shit.
Thank you for this. Like, I was looking forward to this chat, man. I love your interviews.
I thank you for what you're doing. Like, it's excellent. And people can continue to learn the stories of these bedroom Beethovens.
How did you find out about this? Oh my God.
Having something like this to shed light on us is amazing. Like, we really need this documentation. So people like you are definitely needed.
Hey guys, welcome to episode 64 of the podcast. My guest this week is...
My name is Jay Live. I haven't produced for many people other than Jay Live, but I've been produced by quite a few people, and I've shared the stage with quite a few people. The best part had Prince Paul, Premier, Spinner, Pete Rock, 88 Keys, Probe, RJD2, a lot of people.
Bunch of up-and-comers.
Yeah. I mean, it's been, what, first single came out in 95. I feel like if my name isn't, you know, enough, then so be it.
I have yet to score big like Allen Iverson. Maybe someday Jay could endorse a pair of kicks. But for now, long as I can afford a pair of kicks in the closet to put them in, I'ma put them on and walk these dogs. Get my hustle on. Break bread for my youngins so they grow up strong. That's why the flow grow after each and every show. And year after year, bring song after song. I heard amateurs keep doing it till they get it right. But pros do it so much, we can't get it wrong. That's...
It's a very good day when a legend of hip-hop stops by the podcast. We run the gamut, growing up and moving around his academia lifestyle from college to teaching middle school language arts in Brooklyn for several years, until his hip-hop career took off, getting recognized in The Source, and touring with future legends. He's known worldwide as a hip-hop teacher and as an MC, DJ, and producer. Jay Live's music has been a staple of inspiration for listeners of underground hip-hop for over 20 years, but before we get to his story, and you find yourself listening to this podcast for the first time, or you follow me week to week, please consider heading to the Patreon at patreon.com/bedroombeethovens to show your love and support. You can donate a buck or two to the show to keep it ad-free, show your appreciation, and ensure that content creators like myself and Jay Live are able to eat. So I appreciate the love, everybody. The website is bedroombeethovens.com, so is the YouTube and the Instagram. And make sure you rate, comment, and subscribe. All right, guys, you're locked in to episode 64. Jay Live is here.
Listen, we talking about practice. Not a game. We talking about practice. Not the game that I go out there and die for.
Well, I hope you're staying safe out there. I saw something this week that for the average American, the best way to tell if you have COVID-19 is to cough in a rich person's face and wait for the test results.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, eat the rich, as they say. Yeah, it's these are strange times.
Yeah, it's a good time to podcast too, man. I know you had one a few years back.
I actually got to fire that back up. I called it the Practice Podcast, and the idea was kind of a play on words because I had a song called Practice, and I was looking at it like this is not me podcasting, this is me practicing podcasting. So, but the whole idea was to just talk to like minds that practice the same things I practice in terms of DJing, MCing, and producing. So I'm sort of using this whole crisis as an excuse to get my content ducks in a row, so to speak. So this is good practice right here.
You still listen to like Gary Vee and Seth Godin and all that?
Oh man, I love Seth Godin. Well, the Akimbo podcast is like you know, religion for me. That's I love that dude, man. Gary Vee is dope. I listen to Joe Rogan, Bodega Boys. I got to catch up. I haven't listened to Joe Budden in a while. I got to catch up ever since it was like Spotify exclusive, because I use Tidal myself, so I'm not on Spotify as much. But his podcast is dope. My daughter loves it. And then there's a bunch of, you know, a bunch of kind of like health oriented or different sort of things I'll kind of peruse through. I got a lot of Nick's podcasts in the timeline just because the degree to which I'm a Knicks fan is kind of, I don't know if you call it psychotic or sadistic or you know.
We're talking Spike Lee levels?
I don't think Spike's seeing me. He's got the seats. But other than this, I don't think he knows the team like I know the team, to be honest. He's got the seats, though. I'll give him that.
I mean, I'm not a sports. I'm a UFC guy. I'm not a traditional sports guy. But I know you guys are hurting because you know all this, and I know if you're a football fan with the whole Tom Brady thing, you're hurting too.
I used to be a Giants fan, but I haven't really been following as closely the last few years. The whole between the Kaepernick stuff and the CTE stuff, and just the relationship between the owners and consumers, it just really kind of, you know, turned me off. Not even just politically, but just naturally as a consumer, I'm just kind of like, I'm good.
But you're a fan of the New York teams. I'm guessing because you grew up in New York.
Yeah. I grew up on 96th Street, 2nd Avenue.
Oh, okay, 96th Street. So this is like Spanish Harlem in the 80s.
Yeah, I call it Spanish Harlem. It's funny because I always joke that if you walk to 96th and Park, if you look uptown, it's Good Times. If you look downtown, it's Different Strokes. So I was like, I always felt like I was right on the border or the wall between, you know, the upper middle class and the hood. And, you know, like the hood would treat me like I was upper middle class, and the upper middle class would treat me like I was the hood. So
how was Central Park East on Madison? Was that kind of rough too? Or?
No, that wasn't rough. That was actually an alternative school, not in the sense of like, because, you know, nowadays when you say alternative, you think more for like troubled youths or at-risk youths. But around that time, alternative meant alternative means of education. So the principal and founder of that school is a woman named Deborah Meyer, and she did a lot in terms of just changing the way people think about education. They did a lot of things differently. We called our teachers by their first names. Classes were about 2 to 3 hours. Instead of English and history and social studies, there was one humanities block. Instead of test-based, there was a portfolio-based grading system. It was very, very different. And it was still 106 in Madison. And it was still like right where the Wall of Fame is right there still to this day. It was still Spanish Harlem. But it was a good atmosphere for learning.
And then you moved to Philly, and then you got brought to Atlanta.
Yeah, I went to Albany, studied English at State University of New York at Albany. Then moved to Brooklyn and taught for a few years in Brownsville and Bushwick. And then moved to Philly with my wife while she was in Temple Law, came back to Harlem, got divorced. My wife and kids moved to Atlanta, so I came down to Atlanta, and I've been here ever since about 2007.
So after having moved 3 times and putting the studio in and out of storage, I'm sure that presents a certain number of challenges.
Oh, yeah, it's constant. It's constant. I think it might even reflect in the music. Who knows?
But you got kids like around the 18 year mark, right? I mean, they're almost grown.
Yeah, mine are about to be 20, just turned 17, and gonna be 16.
What do you have?
2 girls and a young boy.
See, I have 2 daughters, and my wife and I have punted around the idea of having a third, only if it was a boy, though, because I couldn't take 3 girls. I'd be surrounded by it.
Well, yeah, it's funny how that works. You know, it's like playing dice. I have 2 brothers. And as far back as college, you know, we were all talking about having a boy, and the way things went, it was like girl, 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 boy. And then the other one went girl, 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 boy. So, you know, there's about roughly 20 cousins that get together in the summers in Long Island, and, you know, about 16 of them are girls. So it's funny how that works.
I always wonder, like, maybe, you know, what's the dynamic like raising girls and then there's a boy in the mix? Like, do you think it's affected and shaped your daughters where let's say your son never existed, because I'm always thinking about the male influence of my daughters because I'm the only one there. But if I had a son, maybe it would have added a layer to it.
As real as those distinctions are, I really think it comes down to the individuals and the family dynamic and what kind of structure there is in the home or homes. I kind of see them as very, very specific individuals, you know, my two girls and my boy. Before I would tell you the things that make them girls or boys, I would tell you a lot about the things that just make them the kind of people they are, you know, and I don't know if that's necessarily gender-based, but obviously, you know, it's different raising daughters than raising sons. It's just been beautiful to watch and develop, you know, see the people that they're becoming now as young, you know, going from old kids to young adults.
I'm trying to drink it all in because I know, you know, one minute they're rapping on all the above skits and next minute they're in college. So
right. And the one that was rapping on that skit, you know, with the baby talk that would, you know, where some words were distinguishable. You know, she's a linguistics major and speaks like three languages and you know, wins creative writing contests and does, you know, spoken word poetry from time to time. That's just amazing.
That's amazing. You know? Yeah. There's so many avenues that you can do once you graduate. You can go work in indigenous communities. You can be a poet, a writer, an author. Man, I mean,
forget it. She's amazing. And then my son is like this fearless beat maker, aspiring producer and incredible visual artist as well, you know, and their sister is just this spitfire of just dying to be independent in ways that I feel like are going to pay incredible dividends as an adult. You know what I mean? Like I'm very proud of all of them.
I think when you made the album, Then What Happened, you were creating that album from the perspective of the person you are today. Like, you're an elder with 12 more years life experience than the man who made that tape. I mean, would I be inaccurate in making that comparison?
No, yeah, there's a lot of growth in that record. See you on stage, I try to ride through the athlon. I run the marathon, get in my decathlon. Yo, I put so many shots in the air, spin the discus, and toss mad javelin spears. Long jump, high jump, so many hurdles in here. Take a pole, I'll vault into the vault with the greats, whether soul, funk, jazz, or that straight up raw rap sound. I fill in your forefront and your background. On the business side, I'm picking up the slack now, so we can stay paid in the shade. You gotta call this the upgrade. Then What Happened, it was kind of fresh off the separation as well, feeling like, you know, life had kind of turned upside down at the time. So I was dealing with a lot, whether it's evident or not on that record. But yeah, it's absolutely about growth. And then also partly because the hereafter, while I'm proud of that record, it's not what I wanted it to be at the time. It didn't, you know, like, A lot of my records, when I listen back to them, they sound exactly how I imagine them. It's kind of weird. And my process is such that I don't do 30 records to pick 12. I, you know, craft 15 to be in a certain order, like I'm writing a book. It's more like a sculpture than an actual album. Like, if you think of the word album, you know, a photo album is a collection of pictures, and you could have 100 pictures and put the best 20 in your album and then be done with it. And that's a logical process. But for me, it's more like I'm chiseling away at a period of time, and what's left is the shape of how I see things.
I think I wanted to see a sequel album of that. First off, I know that's a touchy subject with sequels, but I know that was an album of redemption where you were kind of hands off on production and you could only sample from a certain catalog.
The hereafter, yeah. And that was the problem, because I was sampling from the Ryko catalog at the time, but their catalog only goes back but so far, and my wheelhouse is sort of 70s funk, 70s jazz, Latin jazz from that era. And I wasn't really into, like, you know, the sounds of the 80s, the more digital sounds of the 80s, or the more traditional sounds of the 50s and 60s. So it was a bit, I think that, you know, even though I had different producers on that record, I felt like I did it with my hands tied. And I felt like you can hear that in the production. So then what happened was kind of like, well, screw that. Let me go back to doing it how I'm supposed to do it. Let me kind of redeem myself. And I feel like even to this day, that record sort of redeems what I did not accomplish on the hereafter.
I think your mentality when creating is not to compete with like your previous albums in your catalog, but to represent your present day in and of itself. But
I was just talking about
that. There's always this great debate because if we as humans follow Kaizen and every day we need to be better than yesterday, shouldn't that reflect in our work? Because if I look at your favorite albums by your favorite artists, it's all 90s stuff. AT Aliens, Death Certificate, Stakes is High. And it must be frustrating when you have like an album like Illmatic that was crafted by a 19-year-old is heralded by his best work. The dude's in his late 40s.
Well, see, here's the thing. Here's the thing I'll say to that, right? And I'll speak for myself first. It can be maddening at times when, you know, I've got this catalog that spans now 20 years. And, you know, my most recent works are self-produced, sometimes out of necessity and sometimes out of preference because I know what I like. You know, it's like, you know, a barber that cuts his own hair. It's different from a lawyer that represents himself. You know what I mean? For me, as a writer, I know I've evolved as a human, as a man. I know I've grown to where my perspective has a lot much more to offer. As a performer, I'm definitely a master of my craft. So I feel like my delivery on my recordings are far better now than they were. But if you ask people, you know, people in the mainstream that happen to be familiar with me, what their favorites are, they're going to go back to my first record because the first two records were classic. You know, the fourth record was classic. And if you ask people that kind of caught me late, they will gravitate towards albums like Spitta or Around the Sun because I still had a slightly better marketing machine than I do now at that time. But it kind of frustrates you when people gravitate towards your older work. But then I had to stop and realize, okay, why am I like that with certain artists? And I think with artists like, say, take, I don't know, just off the top of the head, Tribe Called Quest, for example. That first album is very important to me. Second album is probably, I feel like, the, you know, my favorite. But I feel like the third album was better than their second. But in terms of like what I would go to listen to if I was just to pick up a Tribe album, it'd probably be Low End Theory because of how much it means to me. And I realize time doesn't stop. So your older work, while you may have advanced and improved, your older work still represents something more sentimental to your fans because they've had longer to live with it. So that I've had to come to terms with. But now, if you take Nas as an example, I think the thing about artists like Nas being thrust into the mainstream, to me personally, I've never met Nas, but if I were to speak to him, I would basically say it sounds to me like his first record. Well, first of all, you have that dream team of producers that he kind of never went back to, which is frustrating to a lot of fans of those producers. But it also sounds like, you know, the second, third, fourth, some of the later records were trying to achieve a certain commercial success in a time and an era where the sound wasn't as genuine. So as a result, you get albums that aren't respected like his first one, even though lyrically, you know, there might be a difference between, you know, Nasty Nas and Nas and Escobar and Nostradamus and all of that. But a lot of people prefer Nasty Nas than the whole Escobar thing, just on the strength of, you know, not being so caught up in criminology and Italian mafia. But that's, you know, that's him. That's his preference. So I think for fans like me that might be purists, might not. I think I've graduated from the purist stage or I've grown out of that. But I've definitely had that time in my life where I was like, nah, it's got to be this way. You know what I'm saying? You just kind of, you feel like your first work or some certain artists, their early works had a certain freedom to them, you know? And I can't remember what rock artist also said that you have your whole life to do your first record and then like a couple of years to do your next one. So that there's really no comparison. And I think that's sort of true in a sense. It might not be fair, but it's definitely true.
Yeah, I was revisiting your old stuff like way back in 96 and you had rhymes like the Penetrations exact like amniocentesis.
Right, yeah.
Oh my god. Oh my God, that line's so sick. First off, I would never have known what that line meant until daughter number two was born, because
we had
a chromosome scare with her, and my wife had undergo an amniocentesis, which, for those that don't know and how ill that line is, they take a large needle and they stick it in your significant other's belly and they extract the fluid around your baby to test it. And it's a very, very risky maneuver, which is why you say, I rip your rhymes to pieces after draining out your fluid. You need anyway.
But yeah, you know, and then like just in terms of that line, right? So at that time, I kind of got lumped in to what a lot of MCs call it, like the lyrical spiritual miracle, just very, very more focused on using vocabulary and SAT words than necessarily like flow and style. And for me, it was very important to maintain that balance. And I think style-wise, my early records, I would do certain things that you wouldn't appreciate unless you yourself were a lyricist or like a fan of lyricism, like songs like Don't Play, where the first verse and the third verse are rhyming the same words in reverse order, or songs on like All of the Above, like All In Together Now, where the first verse, you know, lines 1, 3, 5, and 7 and lines 2, 4, 6, and 8, they kind of form like Voltron and make a whole nother verse. Doing stuff like that in my early years was fun, but there came a time where it was like, okay, kind of like maybe Jordan knowing that he wasn't going to be the athlete he was in his later years, developed his mid-range. You know what I mean? Like, it became important to be able to do more with less, and concepts will become so profound that the vocabulary didn't necessarily need to, you know, I didn't need to use $5 words, but I could use, you know, nickels and dimes to make $20 ideas.
I think it was that mentality that, like, I mean, it was really popular in the 90s, which got you printed in the Source a lot, especially like what was it, Unsigned Hype? And
yeah, Unsigned Hype was for longevity.
Yeah, and a few years later, you know, do you know who was on Unsigned Hype a few years after you? Freaking Eminem. So like it made or break your career.
Biggie was right before me, actually. Yeah. And then by the time I got the Unsigned Hype, Biggie was on the cover. You know what I mean? So yeah, I mean like there's so many different styles of hip hop. I don't necessarily look at what I do as a referendum on anything. I think just, you know, people need to look at the grand scheme of things and understand that there's so many different ways to do this. There's no right or wrong way.
Were you ever worried about being censored? Like we had, what was it, George Bush steamrolling Ice-T Records and NWA Records? I mean, if we look at our history, that we even had Stalin censoring artists in Russia. It happens everywhere. It's a global thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's and that the whole Stalin thing, you know, that brought to light just how important art is when it comes to politics and power. And I think a lot of artists take that for granted, be it hip hop or what have you. It's never something that I've really been too concerned with because I never had the marketing dollars or push to be that kind of mainstream to where politicians would be about, where I'd be on their radar. You know what I mean? Like I was just speaking to my people and, you know, the bigger my circle got, the better, but I didn't feel like I was in any danger in that sense.
If you do or do not have the machine behind you and you're an MC at this time while you're still teaching, what's the line? How much success are you allowed to experience before you contemplate quitting your job? Because in your 20s, you're able to make decisions like that without much repercussions than you would be if you were in your 40s or 50s. It's still a tough decision, though.
Well, I've been doing music full time since 2002. I haven't taught since 2002 in the Board of Ed. I've just been a floating artist. That's the reason I was able to move from Brooklyn to Philadelphia to Harlem to Atlanta, because I wasn't teaching. I wasn't tied to any one particular place.
I mean, it's just, like I look at the craziness of like the time that you were teaching, because NYC district serves over 1 million kids. Middle schools are on a choice program, but choices are limited based on where you live. Like you'll have some variety. I think people have like 20 or so options to apply to, including charters. High school is a full choice program, but not every student is eligible to apply to every school. There are schools only for English language learners, single gender schools, schools limited to kids in a certain geographic area. And that's before you take academic eligibility into consideration. So it's kind of jacked up and overtly competitive when you look at the data. Like,
it's ridiculous.
What's holding education boards from standardizing public schools?
Well, here's the thing. And I've experienced this as a parent more so than as a teacher. But as a teacher, even as a teacher, it was maddening. If a school's funding is basically based on property tax, then what you have essentially is separate and unequal. Because you have schools in neighborhoods where the property values are less, with less resources. And you have schools in the neighborhoods where the property values are affluent, with a majority of the resources. And as a result, you have a much more enriching environment and situation for those kids. And that's unfair, to the point where parents who are paying their property tax or their taxes in a certain area are trying and clamoring to get their kids into schools that they know are better quality for the children that they love. And they, you know, it's literally illegal. Like, you can literally be arrested and put in jail for sending your kid to a place where you don't live. And they're very stringent and very strict about that. And a charter school is this idea. It's almost like the Hunger Games, where like you put yourself in a lottery and hope and pray that you get a chance to send your kid outside of your neighborhood where the schools suck to a neighborhood or a school that has more resources. And those resources are still going to be based to some degree on the property tax in the area where that charter school is. So it's patently unfair to those communities to not just say, okay, let's take all the money from the property tax in the state and divide it by all of the schools. And every school gets a per capita sort of situation where, depending on how many students you have, you get a certain amount of money per student and everybody has what they need. No, it's not done like that. It's done where this place where the houses cost $500,000 to $1 million get that tax money, and the places where the houses cost, you know, $100,000 to $300,000, get that money. And the places where you pay rent $600 will have certain schools, and the places where the rent is $2,000 will have better schools, where they pay the teachers more and they have more books and they have more computers and they have a cleaner environment. It's patently unfair. That's the problem to me personally. You know, if, you know, you shouldn't have a situation where the education you receive from, you know, pre-K to secondary is based on income. That's just, it shouldn't be like that.
Yeah, for people that don't know, I can't enroll my girls in pre-K unless I make below $33,000 a year, which is,
right,
I can't live on $33,000. So of course we make more than that. So
right,
it's pretty crazy that they withhold education from my daughters unless I'm in a certain tax bracket.
It's ridiculous. And that's, you know, that's, not to get political here, but that's kind of why I'm feeling a lot of Bernie Sanders policies, is because he's looking at it like, yo, this is ridiculous. Let's do X, Y, and Z about it, because the whole system is rigged. You know,
I think we're going to relive the Arab Spring days again, where, you know, I'm waiting on a stimulus package so I can pay my mortgage without having to worry about Republicans taxing it or worrying about corporate bailouts, man.
It's crazy. And if you look at what's happening now, it's just an opportunistic money grab all over again.
Do you think that Trump being elected is a direct response of 8 years of Obama, that maybe that learned helplessness is not just an experiment, but also kind of a condition that's developed among people?
I can't remember which comedian said it, but he was like, it's a pendulum, you know, where you got the 8 years of Obama and people were so, regardless of the policies, all they saw was race, and were just appalled at a black man, or whatever you want to call him, an African or a quote unquote Muslim running the country. And he wasn't even what they called him. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, before you can even put Obama under a microscope and call him a centrist instead of a leftist, you had so many people that were like, okay, this is the closest we've gotten to a revolution. And it wasn't, but the racism is so inherent in this country that as a result, you get a Trump. You know what I mean? And I always wonder, like, what would have happened if not for that press correspondence dinner where Trump had egg on his face, would he have even run? And the fact that he was able to win just off of people's fear and xenophobia and hatred and racism, aside from, you know, the obvious social dynamics to where middle America and rural America felt like they needed a voice and felt like he was that voice, despite him being, you know, typical New York aristocrat. That's a whole nother story. But the fact that he was able to dupe them in such a way to put him in a position that he's in now, it just kind of shows you, you know, racism and ignorance know no bounds.
Yeah. And you're still part of the 5%ers. You're still like, that's a derivative of the Nation of Islam. So, and then
that's my culture
that originated in New York as well. Why is it so prominent in hip hop? My theory is because the 5%ers feel a great deal of responsibility for being in a position to affect so many, that they can do a lot of good by reminding young blacks about the rich cultural heritage that was erased from their ancestors during the slave trade. So when I hear Q-Tip rhyme, Zulu Nation, brothers, that's creation, I hear that as giving a little history lesson of their place in hip hop and kind of acknowledging their predecessors.
The history of hip hop and the history of the 5% Nation were same place, same time. You know, Allah was, you know, he left the mosque in 64. And was killed in 69. And one of the last things he said was, if you ever want to see me, all you have to do is get together. Because he knew something was going down. The legacy that he left was powerful enough to basically thrive through the 70s when hip hop was flourishing. So when you talk about the B-boy stance, and I talk about, you know, 5%ers being on that square with, you know, their right hand over their left hand, standing straight up. When you talk about, and word is bond, and I talk about the 5% degree that's, you know, word is bond and bond is life, and I'll give my life before my words shall fail, you realize just how synonymous 5% culture and how ingrained and immersed 5% culture was in hip hop, just because it was the cool thing. You had all of these cats, you know, in their teens and their 20s going around, going to parties, going to clubs, being, you know, the life of the party, the leader of the pack, and speaking this language that was based on, you know, the Islamic teachings of Elijah Muhammad and W.D. Fard and this whole nation of, you know, black empowerment. And like you said, a derivative of that in the streets with a street language, you know, with street charisma, being in the middle of this artistic period that would shape and change music forever. You know what I mean? Music, art, culture, visual art, dance, fashion, you know, it's right there. When you talk about the 5%'s influence on hip hop, you're talking about a very rich history that, you know, people don't even know unless they're immersed in that culture, but they're going to recognize because they're immersed in the culture of hip hop.
As someone from Texas, it was very jarring because whenever I hear Sean Price rap, I didn't know why he kept referring to himself as the God.
Yeah.
And they refer to their members as gods, which is completely diametrically opposed to everything Islam teaches.
Well, that's the thing. You see, the 5% is not a religion. It's not. We are not Muslims. We are not. We do not submit to the will of Allah. It's more of a... taking the tenets.
Are you heretics?
No, it's taking the tenets and the pillars and the principles of Islam and approaching them from a secular scientific basis to where, imagine if, like, all right, for example, you can be Jewish and not religious, right? You can be born into a Jewish family, but not practicing Judaism. But you still, your culture and your language and your vocabulary, there's still a great many things about them from Judaism. You know what I'm saying? In terms of your language, you might speak Hebrew and not be religious at all. So a 5%er is sort of, whenever I talk to religious studies, you know, teachers or students, I call it secular Islam. And that's the reason why you have to make that distinction between a Muslim and a 5%er, because to be a 5%er is blasphemous. You know, you can't really be in that same space because you're not talking about a theology at all. You're talking about recognizing or you know, the founding idea of my culture is that belief is the absence of knowledge, and knowledge is the foundation, not belief. So the faith is limited to oneself.
That would be the nation of gods and earths. It would be,
exactly, the 5% nation, you know? So, but you're sitting right there adjacent to actual Muslims and actual traditional Islam and you know, theological and religious Islam, but it's not that. It just so happens it was born out of that. There was a man that basically said, okay, so you're telling me that I'm God. Okay, well, tell you what, I'm going to call myself God and practice it on a cultural level. Oh, I can't do that here? Okay, fine. I'm going to do it elsewhere. I'm going to leave now. And there you have it. That's the difference between the Nation of Islam and the 5% Nation, is you have a brother, basically the Nation of Islam teaches that you are God, but you are not Allah. And Allah said, you know what? I'm not going to make that distinction. The way I see it, I'm God Allah, and I'm going to take on the name of Allah, and my sons are going to take on the last name of Allah as a family name, and we're going to be the nation of gods and earths, and we're going to do things this way. And that's basically where the distinction lies. So that's why there's a mutual respect between the Nation of Islam and the 5% Nation, because the, you know, on many levels, the agenda is similar, but that fundamental difference makes all the difference in the world.
Man, I appreciate that, man, because I was a little naive on the subject. And, you know, I could have asked someone like Lord Jamar, but I feel like he would just yelled at me. So I'm glad you took the time to delicately explain that to me.
As far as I'm concerned, Brand Nubian was my first teachers, because coming up, you know, that record and that, you know, specifically, you know, the song Wake Up, that song taught me Supreme Math in a way that by the time I was interested and started studying 5% lessons, I was like, oh, I know this stuff from the music. Okay. And it was like, it was almost like a study aid.
Group you guys in as kind of the enlightened guys were like, you know, or your release of like All of the Above, or was around that time where when 9/11 happened, rappers just used the Twin Towers as punchlines back and forth. And it's right. Like,
yeah. And that's kind of why I wrote Satisfied, because I was like, no, this is way bigger than a punchline. This is a moment in history. An unprecedented event.
It's madness. I mean, MF Doom was working on the line that ended up as, hey, you don't touch the mic like there's AIDS on it. And he had for multiple takes been saying SARS, but he said that he thought that the virus wouldn't be around long enough to sound classic in a song. Oh. So I hope the same is true for what we're all facing now.
Well, yeah, people still have SARS punchlines, and it's wild. Like when you consider all of these different viruses, you know, with like swine flu, going back to like Spanish flu, it's basically a drill for the whole world to be like, all right, how do we respond globally? Because you know, the world is so small now. The way technology has made things where it's not just you can catch a flight and be on the other side of things, but you can literally. You know, I asked you where you were. You said Central Texas. You could be in Australia right now. It wouldn't matter. It'd be the same thing. You know what I mean? So, like, the world is very, very small. And the economy is very, very global. Health matters. And it's a huge wake-up call for people to be like, all right, you know, the people you interact with every day, there has to be a certain baseline of health for that to happen. And when that's not the case, all hell breaks loose, and this is the kind of response that's required to get things to some semblance of normalcy. You have to, you know what I'm saying? Like, and I don't think that we're going to go back to the same normal when this is over, whether it be a few weeks or a few months. It's not going to be the same normal, because you're going to have certain habits ingrained that you don't just go back to not washing your hands. If you were the kind of person that wasn't washing your hands, hopefully you're not going to go back to, all right, well, cool, the crisis is over now, I can, you know, just jet out the bathroom like I used to. No, keep washing your hands. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how large gatherings are going to be affected in the long term, but the practices at those large gatherings will probably be affected in the long term, because people are going to have to be more conscious about that sort of thing.
On a smaller scale, if we're talking about learned behaviors, I hope Bandcamp continues these 100% empowerment sales, because they ended up selling.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah,
they sold $3 million worth of music in one day.
In that day, yeah. Nah, I caught a piece of that. It was a beautiful thing. And I actually went as far as, you know, I bought about, you know, 25 songs of my own, or not my own, of I just basically went hopping around Bandcamp, copying people's songs, and I made a mix of it and put it out.
So what do you got going on in 2020 that people can check out?
I'm working on an instrumental record right now called Solar Tracks. I actually put out a series called Actual Tracks, and it's a play on 5% Lessons. All of my albums, actually, the titles are phrases from 5% Lessons. 5% is noticed, but a lot of people might not. So, you know, the best part was preserved for himself ever since he made it. All of the above is caused by the Son of Man. I fast and pray that I live to see the hereafter. You know, Allah's a God, always has been, always will be. Then What Happened is a degree in and of itself. How fast does a planet travel around the sun? What is the prescribed law of Islam for said person of that ability? His own self was a righteous Muslim. So all of my titles come from 5% Lessons. It's just been a thing that I've been doing since the best part. And there's a lesson called Actual Facts that just talks about, you know, landmass, square mileage of the oceans, different aspects of earth science. And then there's a lesson called Solar Facts, which is just the distance of the planets from the sun. So I took actual tracks and just said, all right, what are all my self-produced beats that are already songs? I'm going to turn those into an instrumental record that sounds like a cohesive instrumental record, and I call it Actual Tracks. So now I'm taking just spaced out vibes, unsampled beats, and composing an instrumental record called Solar Tracks, where there'll be 9 songs. You know, I'm including Pluto. I'm stubborn like that.
for all your fans that are astrophysicists.
Exactly. I don't know if Neil deGrasse Tyson's aware of my music.
Well, the next time you're fiending for a podcast, you know, I would say replace me with Joe Budden, but I appreciate you being here, man. Like this podcast is nothing unless it's guests like you that come by. And I think I was teetering on annoying and persistent. So I'm glad you put up with me, and I'm glad you came on.
Nah, man, nah, you're very, very professional.
Well, I appreciate it, man. And also, I don't want you to leave without telling people that your merch game is on point. He's got shirts and hats. Oh, yeah. And
realjlive.bandcamp.com and realjlive.bigcartel.com, where my merch is sold, and I use Printful, so everything is right there. Just drop ship. You can get hats, hoodies, t-shirts, mugs, whatever the case may be. The mugs are pretty fire, actually. But yeah, man, realjlive.com will take you to all of that. And, you know, when people are doing shows and I start booking shows again, my tour info is right there. The homepage kind of gives you the most recent things that I'm doing, from SoundCloud to Mixcloud to what have you.
Well, there you have it, man. JLive, it's been an honor, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.